This is episode Charlie of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, we're back. We're back in New York, actually.
Yeah, producer Dan pointed out to us that there was more, as we thought, background noise in San Francisco in the hotel room than we actually have here in New York.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
It's true, but it's been pretty quiet, generally speaking, in our outside noise. There was this very loud siren going off during my rant about Microsoft.
which somebody said underscored your...
Yeah, it was actually producer Dan said that.
Was it producer Dan?
Yeah, that it underscored the important point that I was making, the urgency. Well, one of the things that we discovered as an urgency was the feedback we got from that podcast was...
thank you for your questions. That was really great.
Tons of comments on Identica, a few people emailed, and it seems to be the general consensus that they were very appreciative of the information. It was a popular show, but a lot of people had various questions about how the patent situation works and how it interacts with the free software licenses. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to go through a little bit how patents interact with free software.
And we try generally to keep our shows walking the line between being interesting. We try to stay interesting for people who are just coming to these topics and also people who are very familiar with them. But when we're getting on a more basic episode, we sometimes like to warn the more experienced people that this maybe is one of those episodes that they, maybe not experience isn't the right word, but that
more
this is a, more knowledgeable people that maybe this isn't an episode they want to take the time to listen
to. What I'd recommend is skip ahead to the, if you already understand what patents are and how they interact with copyright, skip ahead to the second segment because we're going to talk a little bit more about how the various licenses, the free software licenses, deal with patents, which may be of interest to folks like that. But
we're going to start out with the most basic of all issues that we touched on last week, and I think that issue is probably what is a patent.
Exactly, and a lot of people, in fact, Richard Stallman is very famous for talking about how easy it is to confuse the different types of these things that exist. And in fact, the phrase often used by attorneys is intellectual property, a term that Stallman himself has often said he doesn't like. I don't like it either because it assumes that they're the same as physical property.
It's sometimes hard not to use that word, in part because I was looking at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office just before the show, and I saw that in fact they use the term property, and they use the, I mean, so it's sometimes tough because the laws and the regulations.
they want to make that analogy, and in fact it's a marketing campaign. I agree with RMS about this, that it's an attempt to lump these things together and think that we really necessarily need them, and copyrights are really much different from patents, particularly when it comes to software.
And I wanted to say that I think that RMS is absolutely right to call attention to the way we talk about these issues, because the vocabulary that we use frames the way we think about it, and so it's important to talk about it and question those terms.
So the first thing we could say is what patent is not. And patent is not property. It's not something that you physically hold in your hand. It's a piece of paper.
It's funny because the PTO in the What is a Patent FAQ says, patent is property, basically. I'm paraphrasing.
Liars. It is. And it's a simplification, an oversimplification that confuses. What it is it's basically a government grant to have a monopoly, right?
Yeah, I mean,
on a new
useful process.
Right. Process, right. And the problem that we have in the software world, of course, is that process has been expanded in what it means, notwithstanding the Bilski discussions that we've had on previous podcasts, such that generally you can write a patent such that the patent does what's called reads on software. And by that it means that when you write a piece of software that implements the idea, the patent applies to that piece of software, such that you need permission from the person who got the patent to engage in certain activities related to the software.
And this is for a certain period of time. So like copyright, there's a term limit on how long you can have a patent.
Copyright doesn't have term limits anymore. They have perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Sorry, that's an inside joke for those who have studied the issue of copyright expansion in the U.S. Sorry, go ahead. Patents are a limited time. Right. It's 10 years, right?
20 years.
20
for
years,
patents.
Right, yeah. I thought it was 10 and renewable 20. No, it's just
it's 20.
20 straight up.
20 years.
You don't know renewal, you just get 20.
You just get 20.
Yeah.
I maybe should check that, but yeah. I think it's just a 20-year limit.
Yeah, yeah. And because that was the classic thing with the RSA where they freed it just a few days before their limit was up. They mm-hmm. released it to the public domain. Mm-hmm. Like, that helped any.
So when we talk about copyrights, we often say that, copyrights are are related to creative expression.
Right.
And we talk about copyright not extending to modes of operation or the way that things work. It's the way that those ideas are expressed that gets copyright.
Right, when you actually write something down or type it in, that's when copyright comes into play.
Now, it's funny because we were just talking about vocabulary, and I almost found myself saying that's what copyright protection extends to. But I also know that we've been criticized, I think, by Richard Fontana. But, but we always have the discussion that maybe copyright protection isn't the right way to talk about it.
Cover.
Either.
I usually say coverage. So copyright covers the work.
Right.
It's so different with patents because patents you can make a new work from scratch all by yourself, and if you happen to implement an idea that is protected or controlled by a patent, then you're stuck. You have to get permission
really
from the patent holder.
And what's really tough is that it's really hard to figure out, what patents there are, what they read on, and if you even know about a patent and someone has asserted that it applies to your software, it's very difficult to determine whether it actually does or doesn't.
Right. And patents when people first hear about patents, it actually tends to scare developers so much mm-hmm. that they get to the point of being frozen. Because one of the problems is that once you start writing software, it's almost impossible these days to write a useful piece of modern software without infringing some patent in the U.S. patent system. It's really true.
It's really interesting because the purpose of patents from a legislative, from a lawmaking perspective, the purpose of patents is to encourage innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And in software in particular, it has the reverse effect in that mm-hmm. it stifles innovation because
correct.
People are so afraid.
Well, it stifles innovation unless you have a lot of patents. Once you have a lot of patents, once you're big
well, then
and powerful.
You can assert them against somebody else.
It's like, yeah.
And you know that you have some safety there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like saying, I don't understand why poor people can't spend money. I'm rich. I have so much money. Everything's fine. And of course, to get back to that point about stifling and sort of scaring developers, the reason they're so scared is because they just never know. And you put your software out there, you've written it, and then maybe years later, months later, maybe never, a patent holder comes along and says, I have a patent that reads on your software, and I have control of whether you can, and the words used in the patent world are make, use, or sell this product, which is very, very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the free software space, all we do is make things, share them, sell them, and put them out there.
Mm-hmm.
So and use it, of course. So basically everything we would want to do in free software, if a patent reads on our free software, meaning its claims, which are the formal things in the patent that say what it is, turn out to be things we've implemented in the software, well, we could be completely stopped by the patent holder.
And to make things even worse, if you think before you write a piece of software, you think, oh, I should see if any patents read on my software, then you could be considered to be willfully infringing.
Yeah, that's problem number one.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a big
problem.
And then
there's more penalties, right, if you're willfully infringing.
Yeah, treble damages. So three times as much
oof.
Damages.
But it's
just
not
for checking it out to see if maybe there was something there, even if you can't tell.
Right. But that's the first problem. The second problem is even if you tried to do that search, there are so many patents. And to write one piece of software, you might have to use hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different patented ideas. There's really no viable way, particularly as a free software developer, but even as a corporate developer with the resources of a corporation, to actually do a patent search mm-hmm. every time before you write a piece of software. So nobody does it. They wait.
Yeah,
they
and
wait
in fact, we were just talking to a recent patent examiner, a former patent
yeah,
examiner.
Yeah.
We were recently,
talking
to a
former
patent examiner, and he was saying that it's even difficult for patent examiners to determine, what patents read on and, what's out there and how to search them.
Yeah. But there's a couple of rules of thumb that I want developers
to have. We're not having this podcast to scare you.
Yes, in fact, we're having this podcast to explain it so that you won't be scared. The first rule of thumb that I want everybody to have is you'll see these stories on Slashdot and so forth that say, you know, someone has patented walking or some very, very simple technique. Now, those stories are usually based on the summary or the abstract at the front of the patent.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to keep in mind is that abstract slash summary is not the patent. In mm-hmm. fact, it has, I'm pretty sure, Karen, no legal enforceability.
I think that's right. Now, full disclosure, I'm not a patent lawyer.
True enough. But this is from our guide, actually. We're going to link in our show notes to the part of our legal guide that talks about patents. I learned this from our legal guide, which was written by a patent attorney, Richard Fontana.
I think all lawyers that are active in this field have to be aware of patents and how it affects software.
Well, I'm not a patent lawyer either. And actually, I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but about patent agents. But so the thing that actually matters in patents is the soup of words that are called the claims. Now, it's not called soup of words. That's
soup
what
of
I call
words.
It.
I've never heard that.
I just made that phrase up because that's what it's like. It's this mess of words that make no sense.
Strangely structured.
Strangely structured. And they're written basically for other patent attorneys to be able to read it, not for practitioners in the art to be able to read it. So as a software developer, you know, my skills as a software developer don't help me read patents. The work that I've done on free software licensing and legal work that I've done with Karen, that helps me be able to read it because it's written for lawyers, not for developers. So as a developer, you shouldn't even try to determine whether a patent reads on your software because you're probably going to fail at that. It's really difficult to know.
And it's not just it needs to be the whole thing. This is something that I think people also forget is that every claim is a piece of the patent.
Right.
So if one of the claim isn't present or if the patent description as a whole doesn't read against your software, then you're golden.
Well, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Hopefully speaking.
Well, you've got a good argument.
Got a good argument, which is the problem, because most of what patent holders do is fear tactics. They send you cease and desist letters, try to convince you to stop doing the work that you're doing, pay them a patent license, other types of requests like that. And that's really what you wait for. As a free software developer, you should write your free software and wait and see if somebody contacts you about a patent. And if they do, call the Software Freedom Law Center for help. It's probably the best advice we can give you if you're a nonprofit free software developer.
And if you're not, if you're working in a company, then contact your legal department. Yeah.
But as a free software developer, I'm speaking more to the individual volunteer developers. Patents should not be a big part of your life. Now, that's one side of this whole question. The other side of this question is we know that large software companies hold a lot of patents that read on systems of software. And we know that some of those companies, out of the hat example, Microsoft, are trying to hurt free software using their patents. So in those cases, we have to think about what our community should do in response. And we talked a lot about in our last show, and we're going to talk in the next segment more about the licenses that are there for free software. These are copyright licenses that work to help defend against the threats of patent pools that want to hurt free software.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think saying want to hurt free software is an oversimplification. I don't disagree with you. But I would say that for sure. Well, what I was going to say actually is that it's sort of this, we're in this interesting time where there are all these business models set up on asserting patents. Mm-hmm. So if you've heard of patent trolls, this is sort of their business model.
The sickest business model in the patent world, which is acquire, not actually do anything useful in the world, but acquire a patent somehow by hook or crook, and then go around attacking people with a patent just to raise revenue.
But patents, whether or not they think that they're really reading on that software or not, because it's so much easier to just blanket everyone with threats and hope that some of them pay off. All you need is one big payoff, someone to be scared and take a license from you, whether or not they needed it. And that supports the business model. And I think that what we're seeing with Microsoft is an attempt to enter into that business model as well.
They're becoming as we saw at the Linux Collaboration Summit, Jeremy Ellison very rightly presented Sam Ramji with the Fattest Patent Troll Award of the Year because they had trolled with their fat file system patent. So that's certainly what Jeremy and I think about what's going on with what Microsoft's doing with their patent pool. But fortunately, we have been thinking about this problem for a long time in the free software world, and the various free software licenses that you can use. Now, the copyright license you can use can use the copyright permissions to help this situation, and we're going to talk more about that.
And we'll be back with a challenge for Bradley. So we were just talking about Microsoft and last
episode.
Last episode, actually 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Last episode is 2 weeks ago.
Right.
We were talking about the Microsoft and TomTom settlement, and we touched on sort of, you know, what the implications were that that the software in question was under GPLv2 and how it would be different if it had been GPLv3. Mm-hmm. And I know that that some of our listeners are interested in hearing sort of how those work exactly. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit now.
Yeah, in fact, I think the biggest problem has been this confusion that we've been talking some in the first segment about, that people don't understand completely the difference between patents and copyrights. And if mm-hmm. they've been listening to me and RMS and Eben for years, we've been saying, don't forget, the GPL is a copyright license and is working under copyright law. And then people mm-hmm. hear, oh, but there are patents involved with software, and the GPL and other free software licenses talk about patents. So what's the deal with a copyright license talking about issues of patents? Because if they listen to our first segment, they say, well, patents and copyrights, totally different issues, problems, and so forth. Where's the interaction? And what I hope to do in this segment is to try to explain to folks why there is a connection between the two and how GPL and other free software licenses are addressing that.
Yeah, and I think to start out, we've talked before about how unusual it is that software has several different legal regimes that are trying to accomplish the same thing.
Or similar things.
Or similar things, right. And they come from different backgrounds, and they were originally designed for different purposes. Yeah,
copyright being designed for primary literary works and things produced by printing press,
right?
Or
fine artists,
or anything basically that can be produced in
musicians,
sort of a physical medium kind of thing. And then patents for industrial processes, which is really what it was designed mm-hmm. for. You know, being able to get an idea, put it into production in a big industry setting where you have to build a factory to make something happen.
Right. The first software patent in the U.S. was on a rubber refining process,
right,
for example.
So those two sort of disparate systems make trouble for us because we're trying to make sure neither of them can hurt the advancement of software freedom. So this was a known problem to some extent back in 1992 when GPLv2 was written, and there was some effort put in to try and address the issue in the license. Well, how did it get that done given that there was a license for the copyrights? Well, we always talk in GPL space, in the copyleft space, if you will. Copyleft is a general idea. GPL is an implementation of that idea as a license. We talk about the idea that we use the controls that copyright gives us to stop activities governed by copyright law when it turns out someone has not done the best thing for the community. Now, usually we're talking that in terms of they failed to give the source code to their users when they gave binaries, therefore they lose their right to distribute, and other things related to copyright. But one of the things that GPL does is it looks at other systems and says, if under the other systems, like patent, you do something that's really bad for software freedom, you're also going to lose your right to copy, modify, and distribute
software. Right. It basically says, I can grant you permission if I choose to, and I can grant you permission under the terms that I think are fair. So if you do something that I think is unfair, you no longer have permission to distribute. You no longer have my permission under copyright law.
Right, and that's because the default under copyright law is you can't do anything. You can't copy, can't modify, can't distribute.
All rights reserved.
You only get those permissions when you exercise under some license, some set of permissions. Well, our set of permissions include things about other legal regimes like patents. Now, the downside to V2, as I talked about some in our last episode, but it's worth going over again, is it was written in a time before there was a deep understanding in our community of how patents were likely to be used to hurt free software. So the provisions that talk about patents in V2 are basically under debate about how much they actually get the job done, I think is really probably the best way to say it. I'm saying that from the minority position. There are people in the majority who would say, well, it doesn't actually get done what it's supposed to get done. I disagree with that. But I don't disagree that there is some confusion, because there obviously is, which is what puts me in the minority on that. The place people usually look in GPL V2 when they think of patents are basically Section 6 and Section 7. Section 6 is designed to make sure that you don't that everybody downstream from you receives the right to copy, modify, and distribute the software. And if you fail to make that happen, you're violating the license. And Section 7 is much more broadly written to say that if there's any condition imposed on you as a distributor that in any way contradicts what this license says, which is permission to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software, then you still have to be bound by the license. So RMS has often called this the give my software liberty or give it death clause. Basically, it says if you can't distribute in freedom, then you can't distribute at all. And I've often, and many of us have read this to mean that if patent licenses interfere with the freely copying, modifying, and distributing of software, then you have conditions imposed on you. The debate, I think, is that when is a patent license a condition imposed on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that also it bears to mention that most people consider an implied license to be granted along with GPL V2.
That's true as well.
Which is sort of an extra layer on this particular provision.
Correct. Yeah, so there's basically two things. If you look at GPL, there are two things going on with relate to patents. It's making sure that when a patent license imposes conditions on you that make you unable to meet the obligations under GPL, then you can't distribute further. And second, because GPL gives you permission to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software in a very broad way, when somebody gives you software under the GPL, and it turns out they held a patent on something implemented in that software, they're giving you an implicit patent license to do the activities under GPL. And that's where this idea of an implicit patent license comes up. And if you look at some of the work that Dan Ravisher's done, he's given many talks about this, our colleague here, legal director of SFLC, he's talked about this idea of V2 giving you an implicit patent license, because if somebody has a patent and they give you something that implements that patent under GPL, or better said, practices the teachings of that patent under GPL, then they must be giving you permission to do those things. Otherwise, why did they give it to you under GPL?
And the law supports that contention. Yeah. So, I think it's actually very interesting to read and very reassuring, actually, as well. But I did derail you a little bit, because you were talking about what is a condition imposed.
Yeah, and that's where this where I keep talking about Jeremy and Allison and I being in this minority opinion, there being a majority opinion in the community about what it means. You know, a lot of people think that there's various ways you can structure patent licenses that don't really impose conditions. For example, people talk about covenants not to sue. Now, sort of formally speaking, a covenant not to sue over patents, not a license. And I checked this with Dan, our faithful patent attorney, gave me this information. So, in the way it plays out, it ends up functioning effectively like a license, even though it's formally not a license. However, if I make a promise to you I'm not going to do something, did I really impose a condition on you? Well, it's hard to say that I did. I think that the extra part of Section 7, where it reads, if a patent license would not permit royalty-free redistribution of the program by all who receive copies directly or indirectly for you, then the only way you can satisfy both it and this license would be to refrain entirely from distribution. Now, I think that's really clearly saying the intent, certainly, of GPL was that anytime you engage in some sort of patent deal that doesn't permit everybody downstream from you to copy, modify, and redistribute the software, that you've done something in violation of V2.
But there is some disagreement as to the interpretation.
Particularly because I cheated a little bit there, because the sentence I read says for example, comma. The thing is, if you struck the words "for example" from that section, my interpretation would be indisputable, I believe. With it in there, it's trying to say that the previous section, or previous sentence, sorry, where it says conditions imposed on you, that this thing about patent licenses is a consequence of this conditions imposed on you. And honestly, from a drafter's history perspective, my guess is that RMS and the lawyers he worked with way back when, in 1992, didn't really understand how patent licenses were going to interact with GPL'd software. So it was written as best they could with the legal knowledge they had at
and
the time.
And as we talked at during the last episode, you know, this is where new license drafting can be very useful.
Correct. And this is why I keep encouraging people. You know, we were asked by a fellow named Chris, one of the questions we got emailed in from the last show, he was asking, well, you know, what can the community do to help address this issue? You know, TomTom's doing these things and they're getting away with it. They're making these side deals with Microsoft. Novell made the side deal with Microsoft. There's probably lots of, you know, about the Linspire one. Linspire did one. There's surely many more that we haven't even heard about. And Chris was asking, well, what can the community do? The thing is, like I said in the last podcast, releasing your software under GPL v3, upgrading from v2 to v3 is a way to do it. Because the knowledge of what's available about patent licenses as they interact with free software licenses is much clearer and defined in V3 because we had the years of knowledge since 1992 up to 2006 to think about this question.
And that brings us to your challenge, Bradley, which is not my challenge. It's a challenge by Ben Finney.
From
Identica.
Yeah, if you're a listener to the podcast and you're not on Identica, you might want to get there because that's where all the back channel discussion,
all the juicy chat,
yeah, all the chat about post podcast comes up. And I was talking last night as we're recording, about a week ago, as you're hearing on Identica, about how I've been through Section 11 of V3 about the patent license stuff, and I really dug in for the first time because I had not been involved much in the drafting of those patent provisions in V3 and hadn't dug deeply into them. Yet, as I should have. I should have done it sooner, but I did it, you know, in earnest the other day. And
you can read these provisions several times before you think of applying it to different circumstances and see all the implications. I mean, this is the problem with drafting generally. Right. Like you may read something once or twice and not see it from a particular perspective.
That's certainly true, and just reading something is not the same thing. And so you have to, when you look at a license, you have to read through and think of every last nuance of what direction it goes in.
And so, as per the challenge now, Bradley, are you ready to explain the provision concisely?
Yeah. See, that was the challenge. Was can I explain the patent provisions of GPL v3 Section 11 in a concise format? I think, well, it's not just Section 11. There's a couple other places that patents are influenced by this section, but it's primarily Section 11. I think what the answer is to say that there are four different things going on in GPL v3 to affect how patents interact with GPL v3 software. And I'm just going to go through them one by one. And we should think
concisely.
Concisely. And one thing we should do is think of them as discrete things because they're doing different jobs. So while they interact because they cover the various areas of what patent licenses could do with respect to free software, they're independent in the way that they operate because they're independent paragraphs. So the first thing is, I'm actually going to go to the last paragraph of Section 11 because it says... It explicitly talks, remember that implied license we were talking about in V2? What Section 11 of V3 says that nothing else in the license, no matter what, shall be construed to exclude or limit the implied license that you already get because of GPL. So now in V3 we explicitly talk about that implied license.
We explicitly talk about the implied.
True, but the thing is, the implications of copying, modifying, distributing are saying
absolutely.
If you hold a patent,
and
you're giving a license.
And so it's basically clearing. Actually, I need to not butt in because I will interrupt your concise explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Ben's sitting there timing this, right, and going to tell me how many minutes it took us to explain the patent provision.
So, Ben, exclude my interruption, please.
Oh, then we get the timing harder. You're helping me out here, I think. So the second thing that's in there is talking about the contributor to GPL software. So this is somebody who is a copyright holder of GPL software. They're a contributor. They've made a patch and submitted it to the project. That person is granting an explicit patent license on what are called the essential patent claims. And these are any patent claims that contributor controls, i.e. patents that they hold. And they are putting into the software something that exercises the teaching of those patents. So in those cases, that contributor is required to grant an explicit patent license. Or by distributing under V3, they are granting an explicit patent license for those claims. And this was, if you go back and do some research about the drafting history of E3, there's lots of stuff. It should all be made public now, because I know that the committees had a delay for when things are going to be made public, and by now all should be public. So you can go back to read the discussions of like Committee B and Committee C during the V3 process. This was a hotly debated and contentious section, because various different companies were worried about how much patent claims they would have to give when they contributed V3 software. But we now have an explicit patent license, as well as the implicit one that was point one. So in point two, we have this explicit one in some cases. And the cases that aren't covered, hopefully they're covered by the implicit one. So those are the two cases where you're pushing patent licenses out, in the sense that there's something that reads on the software that's a patent, and you want to make sure people getting the software have a patent. And you're actually engaged in distributing the software, pushing it out. Now, what do you do when the patents aren't yours, or when you don't necessarily have direct license to those patents? That's when these other sections come in. So the third thing that's in there is this issue of when you knowingly rely on a patent license you got from somebody. So if you, for example, let's just take an example. Suppose somebody sued you for patent infringement. Not that that happens in our community. And then you negotiated a license with them. Well, when you negotiate a license with them, you began to rely on that license in distributing the software, because they said, hey, this GPLv3 software you're distributing, that infringes our patent. You enter into a settlement agreement and say, yep, okay. So
you knew and you relied.
So you knew, and then you went, and then you distributed further. So then you have some requirements on you, and there's basically two possible things you can do in that case. Either you can give the software to the public entirely, or you can make sure that the license goes all the way downstream, so that whatever license you negotiated with the patent holder, you can give to everybody, and everybody can give it to everybody else, and anybody operating under GPLv3 has that license. Now, I'm not nuts about the escape hatch of the causing to be publicly available. I've talked to various people who had done research on this, and the idea behind this was that sometimes, it's basically the idea that sometimes patent trolls come after you and there's nothing you can do. And we didn't want to say to the community, if you get sort of trapped by a patent troll, that you're out of the GPL'd world. We didn't want to be unfair, basically, to those people. So the idea is that, well, at the very least, make it publicly available so that everybody can see the software that reads on the patent. It sort of becomes a public knowledge fact. And then you can do things like workaround, which is really possible. With patents, sometimes you can find a similar implementation that does the job but doesn't actually infringe the patent. So the goal there is, if you really get trapped in a corner by a patent troll, the thing you got to do is just make it publicly available so that everybody can see it, and we can try as a community to get around the patent. So that's the third thing. The fourth thing that it does is the stuff that we've also often talked about with regard to the Microsoft Novell deal. This is the case where you've got the third party out there holding the patent, that then they come into the picture through some sort of covenant not to sue. So this is talking about the case where there's this Microsoft Novell-like deal where they promise not to sue your customers over their patents. And that's the sort of middle two paragraphs in the GPLv3 section 11. And this case applies to anyone who is taking one of these covenants not to sue from somebody else who's in the software business. So it's specifically for software business people. And they it covers covenants. It covers any agreement.
Right.
I'm sorry. You're right. I wasn't very clear about that. Okay, I screwed up. Okay, Ben wins, I guess. What I was saying was it covers any agreement. It says words like agreement and arrangement. It's any sort of way of hooking things up. And this is a deal of the fact with sometimes things aren't licenses, right? They're covenants not to sue. So an arrangement is a much bigger thing than a license. A license is a subset, a proper subset of an arrangement, would you say? Okay. There we go. I should have said that to begin with. Ah, been caught. Not concise anymore. So this section is what basically makes sure that you cannot make those kinds of deals and give what's called a discriminatory patent license, i.e. only your customers have benefit of the covenant not to sue, but people downstream from your customers, i.e. people they redistribute to, do not have that benefit. The one downside, in my view, to this arrangement is that it's dated. It's dated to start only from the time it first appeared in the drafting process of V3. And this is primarily because these types of deals are so common in the industry. People make them all the time. And it's hard to know if they've been being made over GPL V3 software for a really long time. And we felt people had a right to be on notice about it before it mm-hmm. happened. So that's, or at least the drafters felt that way. I don't know. You know me and not wanting to give businesses any sort of easy way out. But it has some logic to it. It's a reason that, well, once people knew in public and they were on notice, from then on, they can't make these sort of arrangements and have it hurt GPL software. So those are the four tenets.
I think that was a good job. I don't know if I would describe it as being particularly concise, but I thought it... I feel like a critic. I guess we'll leave it to Ben to decide how good of a job you did.
Right. So I thought about trying to make a mnemonic for the four or something. You know, I think that, but just keeping in mind that the first two have to do with licenses going out from contributors, and the other two being dealing with patents from third parties that are sort of coming in and messing with GPL. So there's this two halves to the way the patent stuff works. I think once you get that split in your mind, then looking at the provisions that two of them are that way, two of them are the other way, helps break them down much more easily, I think.
Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to jump in at when we were talking before was just that the reason why GPL V3 explicitly talks about the implied patent is because
patent license
is that when you're drafting and you exclude something that has been present before, sometimes it's read not as a just that because it's there you're not referencing it. It's sometimes taken as an affirmative step. So sometimes you'll see that where you feel like sometimes a legal document is being just overly cautious and listing everything under the sun, and the reason for that is that if they don't do that, the license might be interpreted as not covering that at all. And so where we had the implied license before under V2, we would suddenly perhaps not be able to rely on it under V3.
But fortunately, that's not the case. Nothing in this license, right. So forth. And by the way, I should mention that good old Section 7 of V2 that I love so much, it actually does appear as well in V3. So in Section 12 is actually almost verbatim from the old Section 7. So that's still there. So all V3 has done is built on the infrastructure and made it better. It still has all the old stuff V2 has, including its Section 7, which becomes Section 12.
So your answer for what can the community do to help is to use GPL V3.
I think that's the answer. I would say AGPL, but that's because I'm mm-hmm. a huge AGPL.
Or you use a license with GPL patent V3 provisions. Yeah.
So I want to talk. I think we should switch gears a little bit and go on to. We should do a. We should have a musical interlude. Let's do one last final.
And we'll be right back.
Yes.
I do love that music. so we were just thinking while we took a break for the musical interlude that we should also talk about the Apache license, because Apache has some patent provisions in it as well.
That's right. And while it's difficult, as I guess Ben has now proven, to explain the GPL V3 patent provisions concisely, I think you can explain the Apache ones concisely.
So you're up for the task?
Oh, yeah. I think that's pretty straightforward. It has actually two components to it as well. But there are two. The first component is the same, and the second one is different. The first one is basically the same sort of contributor grant. They define contributor a little bit differently. It's a little bit broader in their license. But the general idea is that the contributor is granting a royalty-free, irrevocable, non-exclusive patent license to practice teachings of the patent of the software they contributed. So it's similar to V3's contributor provision in that way. You could probably compare and contrast them in a tremendous amount of detail to figure mm-hmm. out which one's narrower than others. And it's probably the case that one's narrower than the other in one way, and the other one's broader than the other in the other way. But the general idea for the point of view of somebody who doesn't want to dig deep into this is if you're a contributor, you're licensing your patents mm-hmm. To the community and the code base. The other half of what they do is what's sometimes called a poison pill clause. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a whole poison pill is generally used for so many different things, yep. and there's so many different types. You have to be really clear, because there was a time in our community years ago that people would talk about a patent poison pill provision as if there was one possible one in a mm-hmm. free software license, and it actually got confusing because there's some really nasty ones that a lot of people dislike, even people, hardcore people like me, who want to make, you know, free software as strong as possible, think it just goes too far. The Apache one is not very, you know, hardcore. What it says basically is that you lose the patent license that you got from the other contributors mm-hmm. if you engage in patent litigation over the software.
Right.
So it doesn't. So some poison.
You actually engage in litigation.
And the only thing you lose is the patent license.
Right.
Which I think there are poison pills that were proposed back in the day that you would lose all rights under copyright law. So you would also lose the right to copy, modify, and distribute the software. Mm-hmm. Now that's a really hardcore poison pill. And that is not what Apache has. Apache just has one that, well, if you are going to sue against over patent issues, then you're going to lose your patent license, which is a pretty reasonable and equitable mm-hmm. Poison pill, whereas it's not saying, oh my gosh, you know, the moment you sue over Apache, then you can't run Apache anymore. That would be pretty hardcore, and that's not what is there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty simple.
Now that we've covered GPLv2, GPLv3, and Apache,
which are really the only three licenses that actually have explicit clauses to deal with patents.
We should answer the other question that we received from Chris, I think it was, right?
Yeah, Chris sent us a rather long email, so we've answered a few of his questions. I don't know if we'll get to all of them, but we are going to answer this one, which is, his concern was, well, what are organizations doing out there? And he mentioned us specifically in OIN mm-hmm. To help this issue and to try to address it.
To help protect free software from patent threats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one of the things that you can see that we've done before, and it's somewhat old news now, but it's worth going back and reading. You'll find it on the old, and we'll, of course, we'll link in the show notes to the old news articles about it, is there was a patent on educational technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we did what's called a re-exam of that patent, because there was a free software project that implemented that technology and a proprietary software project that implemented it, and the proprietary software project held the patent. And they tried mm-hmm. to shut down the free software project, mainly so they could sell more of their proprietary software. And what we did is we re-examined the patent.
I was actually just going to jump in and say, you know, we're always talking about how we can't talk about a lot of the stuff that we do. We can always talk about what we've done in the past that we've published.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, this is something we did publish. And
right. We
actually were able to defend this free software project because we were able to weaken the patent. And the way you weaken a patent is you go to the patent office and point out to it that it's
a third party.
Yeah, well, in this case, we were representing.
But
you can also do it as a third party.
Right.
There's lots of different ways to do it. But the upshot in all the cases we're talking about is you go to the patent office and say, we think the patent office erred when it granted this patent.
Mm-hmm.
There was prior art
and
that it did not consider.
Yep.
Because you can't patent something that somebody's already done. That's a rule of patenting. It has to be novel and unobvious. And we can say it wasn't novel. Somebody did it already.
Yeah, or that you basically, when you have an invention, and you know, I'm doing air quotes while I say invention.
Yeah, that comes through real well.
Well, that's why I'm saying I'm doing
that's
it.
That's true.
You know, when you have an invention, quote, quote, mm-hmm. That means you have a year from when you invent it. to file for a patent, and if you haven't done that, then it's no longer patentable. That invention is made public, and you can't get a patent to cover that particular process.
Right.
So if you can find examples of that invention in the public and from other sources from before, a year before that,
like published papers, mm-hmm, and those sorts
or by
of
others, right? Then you can show that the patent should never have been issued in the first place.
Right, and that's what we were able to do in that case. So that's one of the things, when a patent shows up and starts to threaten us, then we can use the re-exam process to help address it, and that's what we've done. So I think that's one place where we've done work. I think generally speaking, By doing the GPLv3 process was a big help, because we helped FSF create a license that better handled this problem in the future, and more software being under GPLv3 will mean fewer opportunities for patent holders to attack free software.
Yeah, that's right. And also, you know, I think from our perspective, from SFLC's perspective, you know, we're also an educational organization. And so talking about it like we are now and helping free software developers understand how to manage the threat of patents, I think is very helpful.
So you're saying we're saving the world by doing this podcast? That's really your answer to Chris? That because we do this podcast, the world is
saved?
You know,
this is my afterthought, you know. Okay. So here's what we're also doing. And, you know, so I guess keep your questions coming, because if there's something that you didn't understand or something that we can explain to help you, you know, feel like you can develop without the threat of patents.
And we're at the point where we get so many questions we can't answer them all, which is in some ways bad, I know, if you didn't get your question answered, but in some ways good, because it means we're hearing stuff and we have some stuff to pick from. We're trying to pick the questions that that we think will be as applicable to as many people as possible.
But it definitely helps us to frame what we want to talk about, hearing from you guys what you'd like to hear about and what you were confused about.
And the address they should write to, Karen?
Is it podcast@softwarefreedom.org?
Yep, sure is.
Well, there you have it. podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
And of course, check out the show notes and see links to things that we've talked about, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.